Hi, my name is Vicky Huang.
Hi, my name is Ang Lee. Welcome to our podcast, Lost Slurp, where two working journalists talk about everything from China, Korean dramas, and Asian food to working in journalism.
I hope you enjoy our weekly chit-chat. Please hit that subscribe button if you want to stay in touch.
Hello, our dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of the Lost Slurp podcast. This is your host, Ang.
Hi, everyone. This is your co-host, Vicky. Today, we have two very special guests with us to talk about an important issue that's been generating a lot of headlines of late. We are very honored to have them here. Kathleen Ho, the beauty director at The Cut, as well as Donnie Aldin, editor-in-chief at The Cultures magazine. Welcome to both of you to join the Lost Slurp podcast.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, it's wonderful to be here.
So let's just get to, you know, why we're here today. This topic has been very, very deeply personal to, I believe, you know, all of us. You know, like in the past few months, you know, there has been a stark rise in anti-Asian hate incidents. You know, we see our elders getting attacked on the streets. We saw the really tragic shootings that happened in Atlanta this past week. And according to Stop AAPI Hate, they have tracked almost 3,800 reports of anti-Asian verbal and physical attacks between March 2020 and February this year. What do you think that led to this unfortunate spike?
Wow. Go ahead, Kathleen. I'll let you go.
I think that there's a direct correlation in the rise of these attacks with the xenophobic language that President Trump normalized during his entire time in office. And I don't think there's any way to deny that. I think that you're seeing people use the exact same language that he used to verbally attack people. And he made it seem like that this was an okay thing, that this was a normalized thing, and that it wasn't a racist thing.
Well, in terms of the recent spike, I mean, I find that so interesting because from my point of view, as you just pointed out, Kathleen, I mean, the rhetoric started way last year, right? A year ago, even sooner than that. And to me, at that time, it was clear this is the direction that it was going. So the only thing I could attribute to the sudden spike is people getting so tired of the pandemic and wanting someone to blame and taking all of that, the accumulation of the name calling and the actions that didn't receive attention and just letting it snowball and escalate, right? I mean, I am thrilled that people are picking up the torch now and speaking. And I'm also a little disgusted that it took this long and something this drastic for most people to take notice.
For sure. I really resonate both of your answers. I think a lot of people are just really exhausted by a whole year of lockdown, and they have a lot of anger and frustrations. And President Trump's rhetoric of linking the coronavirus with China and Chinese people and saying things like, the China virus and Kung Flu, there is definitely a direct correlation between the two. So it's really unfortunate. Kind of going back to Kathleen, your piece, which both Ang and I read, it's a really moving and poignant account of a very unfortunate racist incident that you and your mother experienced in your childhood. Would you mind kind of elaborate on that piece and share that experience?
Sure. So I wrote a piece called Swallowing Bitterness. And the reason why the idea for this piece came to my mind is because for the first time ever, my mom and I were in the car, this was like a few months ago, and we were having like a very frank discussion about racism. And I think this is like the first time to my knowledge that I remember us ever talking about it. And I was talking about something that happened to me in elementary school. And she finally, after like many, many years, was explaining this incident that happened to her. So what kind of happened to her was that my parents, like many immigrants, they moved to America for, you know, this opportunity and this pursuit of the American dream and for a better life. And we lived on this block, and we had like a small house, and my mom really wanted to paint the house white and red because she just loves the color red. It's like very auspicious in Chinese culture. And we had this neighbor across the street who was a doctor, and I remember him always just eyeing our family and like yelling at us for different kind of like yard or like house related things. Like I remember him like yelling at my dad about not knowing how to like properly bag up fall leaves or something like that. And so I remember this one time where we were like in the car and I was like playing a joke on my mom, and I was telling her, oh, there's this other car following us. And I think it was like tied to something I'd like seen on TV, like some kind of like caper movie. And she reacted like with such fear that it was real. It was real very quickly that it wasn't a game to her. And she like had me lie down in the seat and didn't want me to like sit up until we were back home. It wasn't until recently that she told me the reason why she had been so scared that day was because of this incident with our old neighbor. We moved away from the red and white house. We moved to a new house in a different neighborhood. And one day she had been running errands and she came home and went into the garage, and she was about to like close the door. And she saw this man coming up the driveway to her. And he was really, really angry and kept saying things like, why would you paint the house this color? It's such an ugly color. It's such an eyesore. Don't you guys have any taste? And he kept like saying this. And she first didn't recognize who he was, or she was just like, how does this person know who I am? And what house is he talking about? And then realized it was the old neighbor from our former neighborhood. And he had tracked down our address. We hadn't lived there for a few months already. Tracked down our address, came over and was attacking my mom, verbally attacking my mom on the, you know, the driveway of our new house. So this kind of, I mean, talking about this and connecting these incidents, I was asking her, why didn't you tell me what happened or tell us what happened? And she was saying that, you know, why would I tell you? Like, you know, nothing really happened. The idea for the piece kind of stems back to that, because I think a lot of times in America, when Asians think about incidents that have happened to them, we try to rationalize things as being not that bad or not that scary, or just any kind of other various language like that. But it's part of this cultural belief that we have called tsukku, which is swallowing bitterness, where we really try to swallow any kind of suffering or pain and oppression, and it's seen as like a value and a virtue. And I think that this is something that has really restrained and prevented a lot of us as a culture from speaking out against the racism we've encountered in our lives.
Kathleen, thank you so much for elaborating on that and also sharing your experience. The piece was just, you know, so beautifully and like powerfully written. And I think, you know, like it definitely was really inspiring to see and sad to see that happen to your family, but, you know, inspiring to see you speaking out as well. And I just want to touch on what you just said about like, you know, the mentality that we have, right? Like kind of like a shame that's associated with like when we are being the ones targeted, like we feel like the shame instead of like, you know, the society itself or the perpetrators themselves, like feel the shame. And I think that's like also really fascinating, you know, like it's definitely a fascinating topic. And I think for me personally, you know, I'm originally from China. My parents always like taught me to like not like cause any trouble, because like you never know, especially in America, you know, there's like a gun issue and there's also like other issues as well. But my parents are, you know, always worried about me getting like attacked like in return. So they always say like, oh, just like ignore the, you know, like the people who are like verbally abusing you or other people around you. So I appreciate you sharing that experience and speaking out as well. I think it, you know, it's definitely time for us to not like be silent and kind of like break out those like stereotypes or those like cultural barriers we have in terms of like speaking out. And Donnie, I know that you grew up with, you know, multicultural background and have lived in many different countries. What was your experience navigating, you know, this kind of third culture upbringing as a person of color?
You know, that is an amazing question, because honestly, I think I'm one of the only people. So Kathleen, what you just said about Asian culture and swallowing the bitterness, it's interesting. I think I'm the only one that I have seen so far in terms of third culture who now notices the overshadowing of some of the more negative and stereotypical and or racist incidents that people of color who grow up globally in multiple cultures may experience. You know, it's interesting because I used to call it my superpower to be able to see racism, but not necessarily feel it. So I could see it and I understood it and I could empathize, but I was still emboldened to be me and to stand up and to not let those things permeate my skin, or so I thought, right? Now that I teach this at university and I have the opportunity on a regular basis to talk to hundreds, sometimes thousands of third culture kids each week, and a third culture kid is someone who's been geographically mobile and culturally mobile while they were forming their identity and growing up. And so I get to talk and see thousands, hundreds to thousands each week. And it's been interesting to watch the students of color or the people of color who are third culture versus the people of majority, quote unquote, majority culture who are third culture, and how all of us think, oh, you know, we're so multicultural, we're so open-minded, we get it. It's almost like low key, we're better than that. We're better than them. And them meaning people, monocultural people who may not see some of the stereotypical ways they treat other people or some of the thinking that may permeate their everyday attitudes. And what I found is that people of color who are third culture tend to just swallow that bitterness. It's just a one-off, right? Or maybe you didn't live somewhere long enough for that sting to just really stay with you. Right. I grew up, as you mentioned, on four continents. I sometimes say five because my dad's Costa Rican and I like to include Central America, but we know it's not a continent. So four continents and seven cultures. And it wasn't until I started to stay in one place. So really now in the last 15 years, you know, teaching at the university, researching this on a regular basis, speaking about it on a regular basis, really immersing myself and seeing a different way of being and really understanding the history of some of the racist rhetoric that happens in many, many cultures, right? So the direct answer to your question is I've seen that in third culture, for people of color in third culture, very often you feel like you're one of the gang, right? Like you found your people, the people who understand you, who understand that you're different than everyone else because you have the same difference they do. But what was sad for me to see, and to this day, it's sad for me to see when those people of color who are third culture haven't recognized it yet, is when people from majority culture are still perpetrating the same type of oppression to the people of color within the third culture space. And it's almost worse because you think you're so open-minded that you don't pay attention. And that really pains me. So that's why it's important to me to speak out. That's why it's important to me to really make sure people are recognizing what they're doing to other people and promoting empathy and really getting people to put themselves in the other people's shoes. So Kathleen, as you spoke about swallowing that bitterness, I think in African-American culture, because I'm Afro-Latina, so it's a little bit different. And I had to learn African-American culture. And that's kind of like the turn the other cheek thing, right? Like, oh, you know, just keep on going. Just, you know, be peaceful, be nice. It will change over time. And I think what we're seeing is the conglomeration of all those voices, all those ancestors, all that history coming out and just screaming because the voice needs to be heard.
Mm-hmm. I'm so curious about what you said in terms of like being able to see the racism but not feel it. Like, can you talk a little bit about more about like what? Do you have an example maybe you could talk about?
So maybe not feel it isn't the exact way to paint the picture. Maybe to not let it affect how you move in the world, right? And it's interesting because I very often would get people who today I watched a thing. Who was it? Oh, it was a media piece, and someone was talking about Meghan Markle and people referring to her in British press as being uppity. And they were talking about that being a dog whistle, and dog whistle being words that are coded where a specific group of people understand what it means, which it's a derogatory term against you. But if someone tries to say, oh, well, you said something derogatory, and you'd say, well, no, I didn't. That was just this plain word, right? Like uppity, right? It just means uppity. It doesn't mean anything. But in that specific sense, against this person, a specific audience understands that means that this person doesn't know their place. They're supposed to be a second class citizen, and they act as if they aren't. And so for me, I got a lot of that reaction, and I was very aware of it, but it didn't make any difference to me. I still moved through the world the way I was supposed to, or the way I felt I was supposed to, right? I still was me. I still stood tall. And when I say about feeling it, I think when I stayed in the same place for over a decade and also was researching racism and culture and all the different things that come along with this space, it started to permeate. It started to weigh me down. I could feel it affecting me in a way that it hadn't affected me before. And that's what I mean about, so it's not necessarily that I didn't feel it. I didn't allow it to reduce my stature. And I think I'm back up now. Like I can make the physical and mental and emotional choice to be me, mm-hmm. but it's an effort versus before it was like, just rolled off my back. No, you know, that's your problem. And I still feel that way, but I now have to embolden myself against those things.
How did you embolden yourself against this?
Because you know what? It feels terrible to, it feels horrible to feel like you have to be less than, right? Mm-hmm. To only be part of who you are, to recognize that people think for whatever reason, you know, because of the color of their skin, because of who they are, how they grew up, that they're supposed to be better than you. And how dare you think that you should be otherwise, right? Mm-hmm. So having been in that space where I understand and can feel the full part of me, which by the way, the other thing with me, with my personality, I have a very, I believe it or not, I'm an introvert, massive introvert, but I have a very gregarious personality. So I walk in the room sometimes and, you know, I've had people say that I suck the air out of the room, like in terms of like the attention will go that way, whatever the case may be. And so there's a lot of people who don't like that, right? So for that reason, I have tried to, let's say I had a boss that wanted the attention and they didn't appreciate if I got it or whatever the case may be, or even a subordinate, I would then try to reduce my stature to make them feel better, but that doesn't work either. I mean, that all it does is say that other person needs to do the work. So once you realize that in terms of any of this prejudice, racism, xenophobia, any of those things, it's the other person that needs to do the work, right? And we don't need to suck up that shame. We don't need to take that negative energy on. We need to be ourselves, and we need to hold them accountable to do their own work. So that's how I came to it.
I love that you said the word accountable, because I feel like there's a big confusion between accountable and cancel. And maybe this is veering into a new territory for the podcast, but I'd love to hear what you think accountable means, or how you would keep someone accountable.
Accountability to me. So here is a funny thing. I'll tell you a funny story that happened actually just yesterday. Someone I love dearly. And when I was an undergrad in college, I dated this man who is not African-American or is not Black. And I guess he was my fiance. And so his little brother I've known since he was like 8 or 11 or, you know, some young age like that. And so we're good friends, the brother, not the ex. and so, you know, every once in a while, he'll just pop up and send me a text to say, oh, you know, I'm thinking of you, whatever the case may be. So he just finished his PhD And he got this a fantastic job and he was so excited. And he texted me to say, hey, and we, by the way, we have these candid conversations all the time just about culture, because they know that my point of view is so different because mm-hmm. of how I grew up, right? And I'm very inclusive in the way I think and speak. And I work on that every day. Like, I think all of us have things we can learn. And that's why I do this work, right? Like I hold myself accountable every day by taking action, by doing things, by showing up, even when I don't necessarily feel like it. And that's a different talk about self-care. There's times I think you should show up when you need to, and then there's times you need to take care of yourself. But anyway, so that's how I hold myself accountable, and I keep my mind open. I remember that I'm human, and I give myself the courage to make mistakes and to remember that, like, we all don't know everything, to remember that, and to, again, not push myself down, but be courageous to make an error and then accept if I do and move forward. So in the story with him, though, so we have these conversations all the time, and he likes to learn, and he knows he can say things to me and I won't get offended, but I will tell him about himself. So he says, hey, I'm doing this EDI work, which I'm assuming means equity, diversity, and inclusion. And I'm wondering if I can use you as a resource, right? I just started this job a few days ago. It's just part of my training. Can I use you as a resource? And I texted back, no. I said no. And I did toy with the fact of leaving it just at that, because no is a full sentence, right? But because I know his heart and because I know who he is, and I wanted him to learn from that, I took it upon myself to go further. And I said, no, because my mental health is more important at this point, right? And we're talking, think of the context, we're between all the unrest for the last more than a year for me, and all of the health implications and what the world has looked like. So yeah, there's a lot. I've had to really pay attention to my mental health. And I said, my mental health is more important. And I said, here's what you can do. I said, do the work yourself, right? When you do the work, when you do the research, when you make sure that you are very clear on what you want to ask and how you want to move forward, I'm happy to have discussions with you. And I left it at that. And so he texted back and he said, oh my gosh, as I read my text again, I sounded like a little kid who was asking you to do their homework. And I was really thrilled that he came back with that answer, because I think that's what majority culture doesn't understand when they come. So for instance, when George Floyd happened, you know, I live in a predominantly white area. I live in Colorado. And so many of my friends, I would say, you know, definitely dozens of people called me, oh, what can I do? You know, how do I be a better person? And first of all, they weren't calling to find out those things. Most of them were calling to assuage the guilt they now felt, right? To feel better, to feel like they did something, but without doing the actual work. And what most of those calls did was just dump on me what they didn't want to deal with, right? And most of the time they didn't take the advice, right? So that's not my job. That is not why I'm here. You need to do the work. And I feel the same way for the Asian community when, you know, we just saw the thing with Sharon Osbourne, and she's like, educate me. No, educate yourself and then come back and let's have a conversation and really think through, do the work so you can try to see what people are saying to you rather than feel defensive. And that's where I say, be courageous. You know, I get it. When you're navigating a space that you don't fully understand, you're scared that you'll say the wrong thing or it'll be interpreted the wrong way. But you know what? I'm going to be courageous enough to take the step after, of course, after I've educated myself, after I've been open-minded, after I've been empathetic, after I've tried to be observant, because that's where the growth happens. If I make a mistake and you correct me, that's where the growth happens. If I listen, absorb whatever the correction is, and then go ahead and do my own work, that equates growth. Being scared, and to me, that's the thing about political correctness. If you're just not saying things because you don't know what to say, or you're too scared to say things, then that's not going to help anyone.
I love that you brought this up. And this kind of relates to, if you guys don't mind me telling kind of a story of what happened to me in this past week, it relates. So I posted this thing on Instagram last week, and it was a little bit after the kind of the news of the Teen Vogue EIC and what she had written in tweets. And I was a little bit angry, I guess. And so I posted this Instagram post that said, basically, if beauty companies are standing up for BLM, why aren't they standing up for Asian hate? I went to sleep. I didn't really think too much of the post, to be honest. And then I woke up to like hundreds of comments explaining to me how wrong I was in posting this. And it was a very, very quick learning moment. In the sense that people were explaining to me exactly how it was wrong. And I definitely 100% understand now. I mean, I'll elaborate, I think, because I think there are other people, not like us on this podcast, but perhaps other people that maybe don't understand why what I wrote was wrong and problematic. And basically the intent, and Donnie, feel free to add to this if you want, and if you don't think I'm saying something precisely, but basically the post suggested that it posited BLMM as being a potential kind of bargaining chip. It basically was trying to use Black oppression and suffering and trauma as a way to coerce other people, beauty companies, to also stand up for a cause that I was personally advocating for myself. And it was, I don't want to dwell too much on me, because I don't actually think that like it's not right to focus on me, especially considering the hurt that I caused with my words to the Black community. But that was definitely a very eye-opening experience for me, and something that I'm ashamed that I didn't think through before I posted it. So.
Well, but that's what I mean by learning, that what a growth moment, right? To me, the shame isn't necessary. Take the energy of that shame and put it into the growth, right?
Right.
It happened, you did it. Now let's move forward. And what can you do differently? How many other people can you educate? Like we're talking in this podcast, what will you know going forward? And you can help other people in your community. Take that shame and put that energy into that, but never lose sight of the fact of how that felt and how, you know, again, there's the empathy piece, right? And being vulnerable. And if that had happened to you, or if we think back to the story about your mother and this very weird neighbor that sought you out, sought your family out for that's a dog whistle, right? For the excuse of that's an ugly color. Why'd you paint your house that color? That's not why he went looking for you, right?
Right.
He wouldn't have known the house color until he found you. So clearly there's some other reason, but the dog whistle is, I was only pointing out that the color wasn't attractive in the neighborhood, right?
Mm-hmm.
But my point is, the empathy is taking the energy of that shame and doing something good with it and remembering what it felt like, so that you can use that in the future to try not to do that to more people. Will you make another mistake? Probably. Will I? Probably. And that's where I say, I am, emboldened, and we're not talking about just making willy-nilly silly mistakes because we're not paying attention, but when you do the work, when you educate yourself, when you listen to people who tell you the things that you need to hear, and you still make mistakes, because you still will, because there's growth we all need to have. That's what I mean about being courageous and embracing that, and then taking the energy of that, because I know how it feels, you know, to say something, especially for someone who's grown up cross-culturally, right? You know, even the title of this podcast, which I love, there's many cultures that consider slurping to be gauche, but that's not how it works everywhere, right? So you go to a culture where what you think is, I'm just going to say good, now not considered good in this culture, and people look down on you. You learn what this culture expects, right? And then you move on. You could just be embarrassed and you can hide. But no, I say, let's use that for growth and move on and stand tall, because we know that our mind is open. We know that we love people as a whole, and we are working to push everyone's voice forward and make this world a better place.
Sure. I think it's also, it can be like more difficult for people are afraid to make mistakes on the internet, obviously.
Yes.
And that it makes it, it's a really terrifying high stakes place to make mistakes.
It is. I'll tell you, you know, I agree. And this is why I am very careful with how I put information out, and same with my words, right? And that, I think that's what people are missing, to be careful and to think things through, right? Ahead of time. And still, even then, we're still going to make mistakes, right? Because none of us know everything. But it is a high stakes place, and we do have cancel culture, and that's not, you know, I'm kind of bummed that certain people are starting to use that dog whistle. So now we can't use that. I feel like we can't use that term because people might take it the wrong way. But yeah, it's very high stakes. And there's many times that I put things out if I want to support a group or support a thing. First of all, I won't do it until I do my research, right? I won't retweet something until I've read the article, because the headlines are often misleading. I won't speak on a subject like recently because of my cultural background and because of what I do. Someone tagged me, and actually I haven't been able to find it since, so I can't even answer, but someone tagged me about Hilaria Baldwin. And actually a number of people tagged me in a number of spaces wanting me to comment on whether she was cross-cultural or third culture or whatever. Well, I actually haven't followed that situation because to me, it's not as important as others. And I haven't done my research on it. So I specifically haven't commented because I don't know the background to be able to give commentary. But I think that's part of the duty of having an internet and having spaces that are more critical in the discourse that we have. And so we could be more trusting of that discourse. Too many people just not, of course, I'm not including you in this, but in general, too many people share things, say things, do things without thinking because they had a few seconds in between meetings that they were looking at social media. And really we need to look at this from a media scholarly standpoint more critically and really examine the content we're consuming as well as the content we're putting out.
Sure. I also think that the Asian community and Black community, there's a lot of tension between them, obviously. And there's just, I don't know, there was an article, I think in the New York Times Magazine, maybe a few weeks ago, talking about how there's no language to really discuss what is happening between these communities and what it's like to, you want to advocate for Asian American issues, and you also want to advocate for the Black community, but you're faced with doing this in America where there are just, I mean, for one, limited attention spans and also compassion fatigue amongst other things. And I think that it's gonna be like a really, really big growing and learning moment for everyone to learn how to advocate for a group that you personally would benefit from having a more equitable future, but also to not do it at the expense of anyone else.
Yes, agreed. You know, and that's really important because we don't want to engage in oppression Olympics. Mm-hmm. And I was on the phone a couple hours ago with a good friend of mine, and she's also a contributor to the magazine. She's Filipina and she's a third culture kid, and she's very active. Her great aunt, was amazingly active in the civil rights movement in San Francisco, right? And part of all, you know, the Black Panthers, all these things. So this person, Myra Mapius, I hope I said it properly. I'm sorry, Myra, if you're listening. She is such an activist and really puts herself out there at all times. And the vitriol that comes her way is amazing to me. And so we were speaking earlier about how she does this work all the time, yet influencers who are just now speaking up are getting the platforms to spread the message that people like her and the grassroots work that they're doing all the time, they just spread those messages and they get the accolades for them. And so in that, Myra, if you look at the Cultures magazine Instagram page, I had put something up, I don't know, it's probably a couple months ago now, about anti-Asian violence. and someone who actually has been on a cover of our magazine, our Shades of Latin cover, she's Afro-Latin as well, said, you know, the Asian community needs to look at their anti-Blackness before I'll, you know, stand up and support them. And again, we had to sit and think thoughtfully, because that could have been fraught, and it still was fraught. There was a very tense discussion on that Instagram post, and I left it up because I feel like that helps educate people on both sides. But, and of course, and I always leave things like that up. I think transparency is very important. But I said, you know, this page supports cross-cultural identity. We support all people of color, et cetera, et cetera. So the person ended up feeling good about that. And I must be clear, I addressed the anti-Blackness first, right? So Myra, who is on our team and who I know her heart, and she does this work all the time, and she uplifts all voices. She'd been very active in BLM all year, went and answered the question, but she didn't address the anti-Blackness first. So all that affected in this person was their ire went up and their walls went up, and they didn't hear anything else she said on this post. And she said as much, but maybe not in the way that I'm saying it, right? So as an outsider, you can watch the dialogue and see where it's going wrong. But I think also people don't realize, and actually in our summer issue last year, Myra wrote some great articles, and we have some articles that talk about the coalition of people of color during this civil rights movement and how everybody came together. What we need to recognize is that supremacy is trying to divide us, right? Mm-hmm. And playing oppression Olympics and looking at other people and focusing on what they're not doing versus what we can all do just serves to make the oppressors more powerful.
I just wanted to follow up on what you were just saying, you know, what can we do, you know, as right now, you know, this anti-Asian crimes and sentiment and people are speaking out and standing up. But as we all know, working in news, it always ebbs and flows. What do you think, this question is to both of you, you know, what are some of the concrete steps can we take to keep the conversation going, to support the Asian American community and build allyship with other community minority groups?
Kathleen, I'll let you go because I've spoken a lot.
No, you've been so great at speaking. There's so many things. I think first, as an Asian American, like, it's important to please try to empower yourself to speak up. I think that things become more real for people when they realize that it's happened to like a colleague, a friend, or someone that they're close with. And it makes them a better ally, I think. And it makes it easier for them to be an ally if they actually personally hear about something that's happened to you. And I know this goes against a lot of our culture of swallowing bitterness and siku, but it helps in the long run, not only all of us, but also for us to share and I think to lessen that burden. I received a lot of messages after my article where people were explaining things that had happened to them at work where they felt like too ashamed or just like too afraid to speak up. And like Donnie said, it's important to take that shame and really leverage that as a learning opportunity to not let that shame sit with you, but to make things better. I think Donnie said it in a more eloquent way, but I think that that is really important. And whether you do it, you know, at a company, whether you do it on social, it doesn't really matter. I think that that's like one small step that we can do as Asian Americans. And I think the second thing, it's like Donnie said, the continual education. I posted something that was anti-Black and very insensitive. And I think that, I mean, first of all, it shows just how much more learning we all really, really, really have to do about communities and the people that we're interacting with and understanding that tension and really building empathy for each other rather than building hate. So I think it's just never letting that momentum die for yourself, right? Always remembering that there are more things that we have to learn. This is something we have to spend decades on learning. It's not going to happen like today or tomorrow. Like it's going to be like a continual effort to really keep that sustained.
I agree with that 1,000%. I think concretely what people can do is take steps to make a difference every day, to educate themselves mm-hmm. every day, to embolden themselves, as you said, Kathleen, you know, take any incident that is supposed to be shameful or was meant to shame you, turn that energy around and push it out for growth to make a difference in the world, in your community. And empathize, you know, as you can hear from just what I've said, empathy and vulnerability are huge for me. To me, those are superpowers. I actually think you're stronger when you can let the pain in, deal with it, and then transform that into something that can make a difference, not just for yourself, but for anyone who touches you or anyone around you, right? So I really think if we, I've built this into my life. I literally spend all of my discretionary time, my discretionary money, to the point of even relationships. This is what I focus on all the time. That was my choice. Not everybody has to make that choice, but everyone can make a difference by doing something every day to grow themselves, to uplift all of us as people of color so that we can have a coalition together that overcomes all of the oppression that comes all of our way, because all of it is rooted in the same thing. It's not different for anyone else. My same friend Myra that I spoke with earlier today, she was saying, you know, in the Asian community, these are her words, you feel like you can't speak up because the oppression we felt isn't as bad as Black people, right? As the oppression that Black people have felt. And so it's hard to speak up. And I get that. I understand that. At the same time, I really do believe we all need to look at it all as oppression, and it's oppression against all of us. As I said, I'm Afro-Latin. I actually have every type of color in my family, and I love that. I embrace it. It makes me smile. It gives me joy. And I protect that fiercely. I protect everyone around me fiercely. And if we looked at things that way and could empathize with the people that we don't understand and make sure we open our minds and try to affect that understanding, we would make a big difference and the world would change.
Yeah, and one more thing I think I would add on top of what you're saying is to not do it necessarily all on the internet. I think that we sometimes see someone, you know, saying like a comment that like really rubs us the wrong way, and like our like quick instinct is to like clap back, to write something snarky. And that's kind of like what the internet thrives on, especially in something like Twitter. But like, especially if it's like a friend or like someone you sort of know, like it's just like people maybe think that they're fighting or advocating for something by doing that, but it's really not. Picking up the phone and actually explaining to someone why something was offensive usually just ends up having like a much more productive conversation, and like things, it really comes to more of a better understanding, I think, when you do something like that, or even taking the time to like really be careful with the tone of your comments and what you're putting out there. Someone said to me this week, you know, the two main emotions in the world are not love and hate, but like love and fear. So once they said that, it just like really clicked for me and like 100% made sense. That's like kind of really what any kind of hate stems from.
That was so fascinating. I feel like I was listening to a very enlightening podcast, and I totally agree. I totally agree with what you guys just said. And I think there's a long way to go for us. Like, you know, Vicky and I, we have been educating ourselves as well, you know, about the anti-Blackness in Asian American community, like how we can do better as allies, and also, you know, how we can build a better solidarity and allyship. So really, really appreciate both of you sharing. And I feel like this conversation is really just the start of a bigger discussion that we need to have among the, you know, different communities, like in the US, especially like the minority communities. So really appreciate both of you being here and sharing your wisdom.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure. I enjoyed the conversation. Thank you, Kathleen.
Oh, thank you, Donnie. This has been amazing. And thank you, Jiang and Vicky, for having us on this.
Great. Well, thank you, Donnie and Kathleen, so much for coming onto the podcast and share with us about your insights into this really, really important issue to support the Asian American community and other minority communities. Please take what Donnie and Kathleen have said as a daily consideration. Please also follow us on our social media channels. We are on Instagram @loud.slurp. We are also on Twitter @loudslurp.